Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
A nasty nomination battle in the new riding of Oakville North Burlington has led to the resignation of the executive director of the Conservative Party and an internal investigation into the actions of his fiancée, MP Eve Adams. We start the show with a McLean's panel to dissect this scandal.
Another week, another round of experts criticizing the Fair Elections Act. To respond to the scathing reviews, we're joined by the Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre.
Well, this is it. After weeks of campaigning, Quebecers will soon head to the polls. Will the separatist Parti Québécois squeeze out a victory and hold on to power, or will the Liberals form a new government? To give us his take, McLean's Quebec Bureau Chief Martin Patrick-Quinn is here.
We also discuss a new report on climate change in Canada, the government's Victims' Bill of Rights. We examine language politics with Canada's Official Languages Commissioner, and we head stateside to take a look at Obamacare.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Nomination battles within a party can be brutal as colleagues turn on each other to try and become the candidate for the next election. But what's going on in the new riding of Oakville North Burlington is something different, and it has Conservatives like MP Larry Miller upset.
I don't care who the colleague is in our caucus. If somebody abuses the rules, then they should suffer the consequences.
As the week began, we found out the Conservative Party's executive director, Dimitri Soutas, had resigned from his position after concerns were raised about his alleged interference in the nomination race of his fiancée, MP Eve Adams. Soutas had contractually agreed not to get involved.
Days later, we learned of new allegations against Adams. In a letter to the Prime Minister, the Riding Association outlined a series of complaints, claiming she had MP staff campaign for her, she disrupted a meeting, and she inappropriately accessed the Conservative database.
Adams is denying these claims, saying she never used her MP resources inappropriately. She hasn't broken the rules, and she got approval from a Deputy Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister to access the database. To get to the bottom of it, Prime Minister Stephen Harper has launched an investigation, but he's not really talking about it.
To the extent there are disputes around nomination processes, these things are referred to the National Council of the party. In our party, the leader doesn't appoint candidates and he doesn't run the nomination process. These things are run by the elected National Council of the party.
So we're going to start off the show with the McLean's panel. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Aaron Wary, and McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes, as well as political editor, Paul Wells. Now, before we get to the Dimitri Eve Adams fiasco, I just wanted to say congratulations to Paul Wells for winning the Shaughnessy Cohen Prize for your book, The Longer I'm Prime Minister. Congratulations.
Thanks very much. It was a lovely night.
Are you happy with the win?
It's better than not winning. No, it's really excellent to be recognized by your colleagues for having done a good job. So it makes the endless grinding hours of writing the book a little less painful.
All right, and speaking of the Prime Minister and the Conservative government, let's get down to this with Dimitri and Eve and this whole nomination fiasco. Is this simply, as it's being spun now by Eve Adams, is this simply that she followed the rules, it's a tough nomination battle, and yeah, maybe one or two mistakes were made, but basically she's followed the rules, or is it, as we're hearing from the Riding Association, that she has broken rules? This is a serious issue.
To some extent, she's vulnerable. She doesn't have any real serious function within the party. And the Prime Minister has come under flak for protecting a lot of people who, you know, who've had a difficult time. He just put Vic Taves on the bench as a judge in Manitoba. Julian Fantino is still the Minister of Veterans Affairs after he made some veterans cry. And Eve Adams comes along, and she is clearly a little overly enthusiastic and interventionist in trying to get the nomination in a riding where she's not the incumbent MP. And it becomes handy for the Conservative Party to treat her harshly, because that's something that Stephen Harper has liked to do over the years every once in a while, going back to a lobbyist named Elizabeth Roscoe, who worked on his transition team and ended up getting banned from lobbying for 5 years in 2006. He sometimes takes very harsh measures against someone on his own team so that he can't be accused of favoritism. It makes all the rest of the favoritism a little easier to swallow.
So is it an effort to try and take her down, or were there some problems here with this nomination battle? Did they break the rules?
Go ahead, Paul.
There does seem to have been some problems. She showed up at a a riding association meeting where she wasn't supposed to be there. The executive director of the party was waiting outside in the hallway for her. She was told many times to leave. And she seems to have a bit of a temper, so that when, as soon as someone pushes, she tends to push back instead of saying, wait a minute, should I maybe just give my head a shake? Is there any reason for me to be here? So, but I guess what I'm saying is that she has not earned any indulgence from the party or any sort of excess of patience. And they're in a position these days where harshly reprimanding one of their own protects them from allegations that they protect their own.
John, do you think she's being thrown under the bus here?
I don't know if she's being she may have kind of jumped in front of the bus in some of her actions. But what I'm wondering about all this is whether or not we're entering a new era. Is this a one-off event, or are we entering a new era where riding nomination battles become more a part of the sort of quasi-regulated part of Canadian democracy? There have been calls from people from Democracy Watch over the years that they should be made part of the election system. They kind of are part of the system already. But anyone who's followed them knows that they tend to be messy, often much more bitter than the elections themselves, secretive. They involve a kind of infighting that's a lot of fun for political partisans, but not always pretty to look at. And I wonder whether the high profile of this, some of the problems that the Liberals have had with nomination fights or pending nomination fights in Toronto, whether we're not kind of nudging ourselves towards a moment where the rules are going to have to be clearer, more public, and maybe at some point this has to come under the auspices of Elections Canada in its own way.
Yeah, I think just to jump on John's point, I think this is a reminder that if you think the political competition between parties is messy, the political competition within parties is quite possibly messier. The Reform Act, oddly enough, coincidentally, brings up a lot of these issues in terms of who's in control of these riding nominations, how they're run, who's setting the rules, who gets to vet the candidates, and so on and so forth. And these are pretty important issues to sort out. Samara has a book coming out, Tragedy in the Commons, which takes a whole chapter that looks at how messy nomination races are and how the rules aren't clear and how so much is opaque about it. And yeah, I think we are getting to a point where that's going to become a focus because you can't really talk about reforming the House or reforming politics unless you get down to that level of sort of detail of how people come to become candidates. I don't know whether the answer ends up being Elections Canada oversight or whether the answer ends up being, open primaries, or, as Samara has just suggested, that the part of the answer has to be that these riding associations have to be clear about what they are and what they do and how you become a candidate. But there's, this now becomes a big focus. And I think that's, in addition to all of the things that are going on within the Conservative Party, I think that becomes a pretty key point.
Paul, are you reminded at all of the Helena Georges issue with Raheem Jaffer seeing Dimitri Soutis and Eve Adams going through this scandal?
Yeah, and I mean, one has to guard against false parallels, but you've got a young female Ontario MP who had seemed at one point to be quite an asset for the party, and partly under her own steam and partly through the ineptitude of a spouse or partner, suddenly becomes a liability for the party. And then certainly in the Helena Georges case, the party dropped her like a hot potato. And we'll see whether that same thing happens with Eve Adams. At the first cabinet meeting that the Harper government ever held in 2006, Harper said to everyone around the table, "You need to understand that I am indispensable. No one else is. So if we get trouble, you're done so that I can be protected." It wasn't a question of egotism. It was a question of strategy. And it's been... While he's put up with a lot of messes created by a lot of people around him, if the mess gets too big, he has this button under his desk that he pushes, and the person gets sent into the shark pit. And that's just life as a Conservative.
All right, political editor Paul Wells, Ottawa bureau chief John Geddes, and of course co-host Aaron Nuwari. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Nice.
Coming up, we have the Minister of State for Democratic Reform facing the mounting criticism against the Fair Elections Act. We take a look at the final moments of the Quebec election, and we ask, is time running out to take action on climate change?
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. Coming up, we take a look at the Quebec election, we examine a new report on climate change, and we discuss the Victims' Bill of Rights.
But first, we've just gone through another week of damning committee testimony as expert after expert voices their concerns with the federal government's Fair Elections Act. Among many changes to our electoral laws, the act would eliminate vouching, a system where people can confirm the identity of someone who may not have valid ID.
It's believed more than 100,000 people could lose the ability to vote if that happens, and the clear message from critics is the government needs to make major amendments or kill this bill. To respond to the mounting criticism, I'm joined now by the Minister of Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre. It's good to have you on the show.
Good to be with you.
Over the last couple of weeks, we've definitely had plenty of criticism to talk about over the Fair Elections Act, but I'll get to that in a moment. First, I want to talk about reports this week that you're open to amendments, specifically on the issue of vouching. Are you considering making changes so that you replace vouching with a declaration system similar to the one that we see in Manitoba or Australia?
I haven't seen any amendments of that type, so I can't comment on them. But our position is that people should bring their ID when they vote, and that position will not change.
Did you tell Conservative senators that it's an option that you would look at?
The Senate caucus meets in confidentiality, as has been a longstanding tradition on Parliament Hill for all parties, and we will respect that confidentiality. That being said, the Fair Elections Act is common sense, and it is reasonable. I should also point out that our changes to vouching have been widely supported by the public. The average Canadian just thinks that's reasonable. It's a classic example of the disconnect between the elites and the everyday common people.
Let's talk about one of the people that you call an elite, former Auditor General of Canada, Sheila Fraser, who now co-chairs an advisory board on election laws. She says, quote, "It is really an attack on our democracy, and we should all be concerned about that." She's a woman who your party had praised for her integrity, for exposing the Liberal sponsorship scandal. Now you're calling her an elite. How can you push forward with the bill when somebody that your party has praised says that it's going to disenfranchise thousands of voters and undercut the independence of the chief electoral officer?
Look, I'm aware that that is Elections Canada's position. We've been aware of that for a long time. And we have considered, taken carefully into consideration all of the views of the chief electoral officer, and in some respects, we just simply disagree with him.
But I'm not talking about the chief electoral officer. I'm talking about Sheila Fraser, who's the former auditor general. Yes, she is working with Elections Canada right now, but she is somebody who your party has praised many times before in the past for her integrity and for her work. Do you think she's wrong?
Listen, we're aware of Elections Canada's position on all these issues, and we accept that they have a different point of view. That's fair in a democracy, but we believe that people should bring their ID when they vote, and Canadians agree with us on that.
But do you think Sheila Fraser is wrong with her assessment of your act?
I believe in the Fair Elections Act. It's fair, it's reasonable, and it's common sense. The Canadian people agree with it, and while Elections Canada is entitled to its point of view on this, we take a different one.
In 2004, Stephen Harper praised Sheila Fraser, saying that she didn't say that she thought something smelled fishy. She identified the fish. And in this case, Minister Poilievre, she's identifying your bill as the fish. So how can you Canadians have confidence in that when somebody the party had praised is now raising concerns about this bill?
I mean, I can just reiterate what I've been saying over and over again. Elections Canada has taken taking these positions from the very beginning, and that's fine. We live in a free society where this government agency is entitled to its opinion, but the agency serves Parliament, not the other way around.
I want to talk a little bit about Harry Neufeld. He's a former BC electoral officer. He wrote a report for Elections Canada, one that you've cited many times in your defense of the Fair Elections Act and the reasoning for pushing through with some of the controversial measures. But he's claiming that you're misrepresenting his words. Did you take his report out of context?
No, not at all. I took it right in context. I've accurately quoted the fact that he reported there were 50,735 irregularities related to vouching. These were not small clerical mistakes. They were serious enough that, according to Mr. Neufeld's report, they could lead to a court invalidating a vote or overturning an election result. I think that's pretty serious. So I agree with those facts in his report. He has recommendations that are different than the decisions we made in the Fair Elections Act. Again, we live in a democracy. He has the right to, to author recommendations, and parliamentarians elected by the people have the responsibility to write the law.
But you've used his report and quoted his report to talk about voter fraud, and he said that that's not exactly what he was talking about at all, and he says that you're misquoting him, and I'm sure if somebody took your words...
No, I don't believe you said that, actually.
Sorry, not misquoting, misrepresenting his words.
Thank you. I think this is the reality. I disagree with his recommendations. I've always disagreed with them. I have the right to disagree with his recommendations. And I continue to disagree with his recommendations. He has the right to author a report. He does not have the right to author the law. He's not elected. He's not a parliamentarian. If he wants to write the law, he can get elected and try to do that. It's a democracy in that respect.
The current federal chief electoral officer, the former federal chief electoral officer, the CEOs of BC, Northwest Territories, Ontario, the current and former commissioners of Canada's elections, Harry Neufeld, the Assembly of First Nations, Fair Vote Canada, student groups, groups for people with disabilities, all of these people are saying the bill, as it stands, they're asking for some big amendments, but as it stands, they're saying this bill is bad. Can you name one nonpartisan group or individual with electoral expertise that actually supports this bill as it stands?
Sure. Ian Lee testified favorably of it towards the bill. The Canadian National Institute for the Blind had very favorable comments about the bill, and we'll have more witness testimony as we go forward.
But Ian Lee is a business professor, not an electoral expert, and the CNIB even expressed issues with this bill as well.
Yeah, the CNIB gave some very favorable comments to the work that we've done with them and with the requirements that we've imposed on Elections Canada to inform disabled Canadians of the special tools available to help them vote. And I've been meeting with them and working with them to find out ways we can improve the system even more for disabled people.
But can you name one electoral expert?
Well, I think I already did name Ian Lee.
But he's a business professor. He's not an electoral expert.
I think the problem we're having here is that you're defining anyone who's against the bill as an expert and anyone who's for the bill as a non-expert. That is not how we define expertise. So the reality is the Fair Elections Act is based on reasoned common sense. That's why the Canadian people support it. And we'll keep moving forward.
My definition of expertise are people like chief electoral officers from across the country, as opposed to a business professor. And the last question I have for you here, because I know you need to go, but why is it important to get this bill pushed through by the end of the spring sitting? Because I understand you want to try and have it pass through the Senate before the end of June.
Listen, I think that the Fair Elections Act is based on reason, common sense, and we need to get its provisions into place so that they can be implemented before the next election. So we look forward to move to the progress ahead.
That was the Minister of State for Democratic Reform, Pierre Poilievre. To listen to the full interview, go to the Maclean's website.
We're in the final moments of the Quebec election campaign. After weeks of discussing separation from Canada and a controversial charter of values, the Parti Québécois has sunk in the polls, which means the province could have a new Liberal government. To dive deeper into the issues, I'm joined now by Maclean's Quebec bureau chief, Martin Patrickin. Marty, as the campaign comes to a close, where do you think things stand?
Well, it's been a crazy campaign. I mean, everybody talks about sort of the level of kind of the brutality and the political brutality and the name calling and the slinging of mud and all that. And it was fairly dirty. And I think a big reason for that was going into the campaign that the support for either party sort of seemed to switch from back to forth almost like schizophrenically. You know, like it was just going PQ liberal with a stopover to the CAQ in between there. And I think the party's figured out, rightly so, I would argue, is that in order to sort of best get people on your side in a situation like that is to go negative, which is sort of exactly what happened.
You've covered a few campaigns in Quebec. How would you sort of compare this one to those campaigns, particularly, I guess, in terms of the PQ, which seems to have been the story, at least from where I sit?
It's an interesting phenomenon, and I've seen it a little bit before in the past, but not nearly to this extent. When there's a threat of a PQ government coming in, there is a sudden you know, almost panic, similar panic that you see in the rest of the country, certainly in Ottawa, when a PQ government might come into power, and you see the mobilization of the Liberal vote, the silent Liberal vote. People just come out and say, you know, the only reason we're voting Liberal, they're definitely holding their nose, and they're voting Liberal because they do not want a Parti Québécois government for all the economic uncertainty that would bring. For various reasons, that's one of the things. The other thing too is the sort of the collapse of the idea of sovereignty itself. You know, everybody's talking about it's Pierre Carpelado's fault for having lost this election. You know, he was got up there and said those magic 26 words where he said he wanted to make he's getting into politics for his kids because he wanted to make Quebec a country and all that kind of stuff. I find it extremely disingenuous on the part of the PQ brain trust to blame anything on him. That's article number one of the party. Now, if you're going to blame a guy for talking about article number one of your party, then I think you have some soul searching to do. But be that as it may, I mean, as we've seen, there's been no traction on the issue of sovereignty. There is no traction on the issue of language. There was no traction on the issue of the charter. You know, the charter wasn't nearly the boon that the PQ thought it was going to be. That's the charter of secularism, which would remove the which would prevent public service employees from wearing religious symbols.
Have the Liberals gone out and won this campaign, or have they sort of just benefited from the PQ's collapse?
Yeah, I honestly think it's the latter. Couillard is not the most electrifying human being on the planet, and I think his handlers recognize the sort of inherent instability within the PQ, and we're just eager enough to sort of park their bus on the side of the road and watch the car crash happen. I mean, we went into this election thinking that you know, Couillard was dead in the water, and the PQ had the wind in its sails, and it did. You know, the PQ came in. Marwa was more popular, arguably, than Couillard as a leader, and people had sort of warmed up to her to the extent that they could, and the PQ struck and thought they were going to be able to cakewalk this election and right into power, into a majority territory. The fact that they didn't has next to nothing as to what Couillard did. Couillard ran a very steady as she goes campaign, a very understated. It's everything having to do with the PQ implosion. I mean, you just have to look at the support amongst Francophones. It's mind-blowing to me that Couillard was able to capitalize on the PQ's campaign by seeing that there's a switch of something in the order of, you know, 12 to 18 points Francophone support to the Liberals in the space of a month, which is like it's practically unheard of.
How unpredictable are things at this point still? And, you know, how uncertain, I guess, is the result?
There is a certain amount of unpredictability, for sure. You know, we're talking here like the Liberals are going to walk in now. I don't necessarily think that's a 100% possibility, and I think a lot of it has to do with where that two things: where the CAQ, which is the sort of the upstart third right of center party, had a very good last week with François Legault. And so, you know, some of those ridings that might have gone Liberal or PQ might still get a resurgence, benefit from that resurgence. Whether he can hold on to 18 seats, I highly, highly doubt it. CAQ had 18 seats going into it, and I highly doubt Mr. Legault can hang on to all of them. But he ran a very, very good campaign in the last week, and that will be the unpredictability as to whether or not we have a minority or majority government.
That was McLean's Quebec Bureau Chief, Martin Patrickin.
Earlier this week, the Harper government unveiled its Victims' Bill of Rights, following through on a campaign promise from the 2011 election. The proposed law would ensure victims are given information about cases in which they're involved, such as a copy of a bail or probation order or details of a criminal's parole. But critics argue there isn't enough here to actually help victims, and one Toronto lawyer, Clayton Ruby, calls it shallow symbolism. Justice Minister Peter McKay joined me to address these criticisms.
To entrench the rights of people who have been aggrieved, who have suffered greatly, who feel that in some cases they have not been afforded the respect that they deserve and the voice that they want heard by the system. All of these efforts are anything but shallow or trite. They are in fact substantive and very real and well-intended.
Unfortunately, we can't air the full interview with Justice Minister McKay this week, but to check it out, go to mcleans.ca.
Coming up, we take a look at a new report on climate change, the politics of language, and we go stateside to talk healthcare. Welcome back to The Hill. Coming up, a look at language politics. We talk about the deadline for Obamacare south of the border, and we have question period in review. But first...
This week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released another of its reports on global warming. With a work of more than 700 scientists, the panel's reports are authoritative. But are the politicians listening, especially here in Ottawa? One of the report's lead writers is Carleton University professor John Stone. And John Geddes, you caught up with him. What did you find out?
Cormac, you know, Professor Stone is an interesting character. He's been around the climate change issue for more than three decades. In this latest panel report, he and his colleagues are painting a pretty grim picture. More droughts in Africa, forest fires here in North America, and the Arctic ice and permafrost is apparently melting even faster than we previously feared. So I asked him if it's now too late to put the brakes on climate change, if it's maybe time to concentrate on preparing for a hotter planet. Here's what he said.
We're not past the stage where we can do something about it. We clearly have to tackle the root cause of the problem, which is our emissions from the burning of fossil fuels. That's altering the climate. So we've got to reduce our emissions. And the sooner we reduce our emissions, the better. The longer we take to do that, the riskier it becomes, the more expensive it becomes. But there are certain impacts that are now inevitable because of what we've already done to the climate system through our past emissions. The climate system has a memory, and it won't let us forget. And so there are certain impacts that are now essentially inevitable. And so we're going to have to adapt. Adaptation is not simply a policy option anymore, it becomes a policy imperative. So we have to do both. We have to mitigate and we have to adapt. But it's not too late, but time is running out.
So he says time is running out, but what exactly does that mean? Stone told me that the panel's scientists can only warn politicians about what's happening. It's up to the governments to decide what level of global warming is too dangerous to allow. Here he is on that point.
So governments have agreed amongst themselves that for them dangerous means we should avoid temperature increases of more than 2 degrees Celsius. So if you take that as a target, then that peak of our emissions has to occur within the next 5 years or so. And then we've got to decline our emissions at 5% a year or something like that. So that's telling us we need to start reducing our emissions significantly soon.
You've got to remember that he's been around this issue since the late 80s. I couldn't help wondering if he doesn't sometimes feel like giving up. Here's a bit of our conversation with me prodding him a little on what it's like to have been slogging away all these years against a lot of political resistance.
I worked for Environment Canada for the last 20 years of my career on the climate change issue. And I was involved in the development of many climate change programs, policies. And sometimes those plans have been really elaborate and one got the sense that there was political determination, will behind them. Where Canada did publicly say that we will take on a certain commitment. We had all sorts of targets. We had all sorts of programs. We had the Green Plan. We were spending money. Amal Rooney was a key figure in that. He spoke at the Toronto Conference on the Changing Atmosphere in 1988.
1988, we're talking about a long time ago now, and nothing's happened, Professor. I mean,
Our emissions have not gone down.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the litmus test of it all. So I've seen a lot of plans come and go with all sorts of aspirational targets, which we've missed. I don't know of what the present government's current change plan is.
So Stone feels like he's in the dark on the Conservative government's policy on climate change. But there is a potential point of contact here. He wrote the IPCC's chapter on polar regions, and the current environment minister is Leona Aglukkaq, who is, of course, an Inuit woman from Nunavut. I couldn't help wondering what the two of them talk about when they have a conversation, if they have a conversation. Here's what Stone said when I asked him about it.
I haven't talked to an environment minister for the last 5 or 6 years.
That's worse, shocking, isn't
worse
it?
Worse than that, my sense is that with one or two exceptions, none of the environment ministers have had a briefing on the science of climate change, even from their own scientists. I was invited into Environment Canada recently to brief some of the policy people. They told me this is the first time they've had such a briefing on the science. I mean, I was shocked by that. That certainly I was. It wasn't like that when I was there.
I'm sorry, can I pin you down on that? So you're saying that the senior policy people in Environment Canada have not been briefed on climate change science in recent times?
That's what they were telling me. Recently.
Does that not strike you as scandalous? I mean...
Well, I wouldn't use the word scandalous. It's rather shocking.
That was John Stone, a Carleton University professor and a lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report this week. If you're interested in more about what Leona Aglukkaq, the Canadian Environment Minister, has said on these issues, check out some of what we've got on macleans.ca.
Thank you, Macleans Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Canada's Official Languages Commissioner, Graham Fraser, is recently back from Barcelona, where he attended a meeting of an international association of language commissioners. And you probably thought only Canada had one. Fraser is now the president of the Global Club of Language Commissioners. He'll be hosting their conference next year in Canada. He spoke to Macleans political editor Paul Wells about language politics around the world and how English is taking over.
What are the challenges of official languages in other countries, and how comparable are they to what we face in Canada?
Well, the striking thing for me was just how comparable they are. We live in a world in which increasingly English is the dominant world language, that it's the language of research, it's the language of international trade, it's the language of tourism and travel. And so it is a challenge, particularly for minority languages, in a situation where members of the majority linguistic community in that country are often likely to say, why should I learn Tamil when I should really be learning English? Why should I learn Catalan when English is increasing the language of communication? And what we all have in common is a belief in the importance of maintaining, supporting, promoting, and protecting the use of our minority national languages.
That's political editor Paul Wells speaking with Canada's official languages commissioner, Graham Fraser. For the full interview, go to macleans.ca.
It's now time to go south of the border. 4 years ago, the U.S. Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, creating a universal health insurance system for the United States. It was a big achievement for President Barack Obama, but it also sparked a political backlash from critics who said it would harm the health care system and damage the economy. But on Tuesday, as the deadline for so-called Obamacare passed, the president was happy to mock his critics and announce more than 7.1 million people had enrolled for coverage this year.
Armageddon has not arrived. Instead, this law is helping millions of Americans. And in the coming years, it will help millions more.
For more on Obama's health care reform, Macleans Washington Bureau Chief Louisa Savage speaks with health policy analyst Susan Denser, the senior policy advisor for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Well, let's talk about who is signing up. There was a lot of concern that young and healthy people, the so-called young invincibles, were not signing up in numbers relative to their proportion of the population, and that perhaps the enrollees would be older and sicker. And President Obama went to great lengths, even appearing on a comedy show, to try to appeal to young people to enroll. Do we know if they're actually doing it?
The numbers through the 1st of March suggests that about a quarter of the enrollees, more or less, have been people between 18 and 35. Sometimes it is true that you take as a proxy youth versus age in terms of health status, but it really is only a rough proxy. What will really matter is when people actually are covered, start using or not using healthcare services, and then you get an actual sense of whether there are going to be claims, so-called insurance claims, coming out of them being enrolled in healthcare or not. That piece we won't know for quite some time. So it is the case that, roughly speaking, about a quarter of the enrollees overall seem to be in this younger category, 18 to 35. But as I say, we won't know for at least another year what the actual claims experience of all of the new enrollees is likely to be.
And explain why this matters. Why do we want to have young and healthy people enrolled?
Well, health insurance works best if you're spreading the costs of a relatively fewer group of sick people across a broad group of sick and healthy people, because that way you're taking the high costs and you're spreading them across a large population. If you think about how well an insurance company would work if it only sold policies to sick people, the prices would have to be very, very high, and the company would be paying out a lot in claims. Mm. And because the prices would be so high, nobody would be able to afford to be in it.
And what happens to the Affordable Care Act system if more young people or enough healthy people don't sign up? Is there some kind of backstop to keep premiums from going up for everybody?
Well, first of all, keep in mind that the risk pools are separate. So there is a separate risk pool for the people who are buying coverage through the exchanges. It's not melded into, say, a national risk pool. So there's no reason that even if some of the plans on the exchanges got into difficulty, that would spill over to the rest of the U.S. public. So that's point number one. Point number two is that there were three particular provisions built into the Affordable Care Act that are intended to address the fact that, as you might expect, if you have people who haven't had health care coverage and suddenly you give them health care coverage, you have to anticipate that they're going to be, at least at the outset, using a lot of health care services. And so there were three particular provisions created in the law to moderate the effect that might occur if some health plans attracted a worse risk pool than others did. And there was a way of essentially transferring funds among those plans in a way to even things out.
So this is money coming from the insurance companies, not from taxpayers.
These programs are paid for by the healthcare payers themselves.
Okay.
That's correct.
And in fact,
if everything works according to plan, the federal government will actually make a little bit of money off of this program.
Now, this is going to be a big political issue in the coming November elections. Republicans say it's a failure, and Democrats are trying to decide to what extent they're embracing it, to what extent they're campaigning on wanting to reform the law. How would you advise bystanders looking at this to think about how do we evaluate if it's a success or a failure?
Well, one hallmark of success, obviously, is going to be ultimately if the rate of uninsurance goes down and if it goes down substantially. We already know it's not going to go down as much as had originally been hoped, because one big part of the coverage expansion was the intention of having a lot of people go into Medicaid. And we know that one outcome of the Supreme Court decision in 2012 was that states were given the option about whether or not to expand their Medicaid programs. And so far, 26 states have elected to do that, but it means a lot of states have not gone that direction as yet. Now we're going to have to see how many people do get covered through these other mechanisms. So that will be step number one. Another important part of the Affordable Care Act was designed to sow the seeds for reform of the healthcare system itself, the way we deliver healthcare in the United States and the way we pay for it, and try to get things on a much more sustainable footing in terms of healthcare expenditures. We have seen health spending in the U.S. grow at historically low rates now for the last several years. It's uncertain whether that low rate of growth will continue, but if we do see a low rate of growth, relatively speaking, in health spending over the next several years, then we'll also have some sense that some of the delivery and payment system reforms that we sowed the seeds of in the Affordable Care Act, that those are taking hold as well.
Mm-hmm. And this is obviously a very different system from the Canadian system of a single payer, government-run system, insurance system. So there are these big disparities between the states, as you mentioned. There's also a big role for employers And there's been some concern that some employers are cutting back on employee hours to 30 hours per week just to be under the threshold at which they'd have to start providing or helping pay for employees' health insurance. Is there anything to be done about that?
There is a proposal in Congress to move the threshold so that a full-time employee is a 40-hour-a-week employee, not a 30-hour-a-week employee. And if that legislation is ultimately enacted, that should change the situation a bit. It's important to point out, though, the U.S. has been historically, we've seen employment provided insurance slowly decline. And what we've done with the Affordable Care Act is create this other mechanism, which is to enable people to buy private coverage through the exchanges. So we can imagine over time that probably is going to be the way more and more Americans obtain their health coverage.
That's McLean's Washington Bureau Chief Louisa Savage discussing Obamacare with health policy analyst Susan Denser.
And now it's time for our question period and review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on McLean's.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action this week on the floor of the House of Commons.
Conservatives were still coping with all kinds of attention on the Dimitri Soutis Eve Adams nomination scandal as they stumbled into another week in the Commons. On Monday, an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report warned of impending doom thanks to the world's collective inability to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It took a while, but Liberal MP Joyce Murray eventually asked Environment Minister Leona Aglukkaq how exactly the government is fighting climate change.
Our government is taking actions on climate change. We are a founding member and major financial contributor of an international coalition taking action to reduce pollutants like black carbon and methane. We have also made addressing these pollutants a priority under the Arctic Council chairmanship of Canada. We've contributed $1.2 billion in developing countries so that they can reduce emissions. And for example, we are making investments in projects in Kenya, in Mexico, in Colombia, in Chile to help them adapt to climate change and strengthen their economies.
Those aren't Aglukkaq's typical talking points on climate change. Usually she lashes out at dithering liberals and tax-frenzied New Democrats, the kinds of partisan attacks that Jim Kyrgyanis, a 25-year Liberal MP who resigned on Tuesday, told reporters are ruining Parliament's decorum.
From when I started coming in here, the collegiality has gone out the window. This is more toxic. And unfortunately, the toxicity has come from the side of the government. You do what you do in there, we play to the cameras, but when you go out, you know, like, a handshake will not matter. And there's individuals in our midst that are that bring more toxic than ever. And these people are ministers, and they don't understand that, you know what, do what you do in the House, do your speeches, talk about policy, don't take personal attacks.
Decorum gave way to a parliamentary showdown on Wednesday when NDP leader Tom Mulcair took on the Prime Minister. Tory MPs are forcing Mulcair to defend his party's outreach efforts at a parliamentary committee. Unfazed and with a smile, Mulcair upped the ante.
It'll be an honor for me, Mr. Speaker, to appear before that committee. Will the Prime Minister do the same to explain about his guest and his challenger?
Later Wednesday, former Auditor General Sheila Fraser told the Canadian press that the government's Fair Elections Act represents an attack on Canada's democracy. Conservatives used to thank Fraser for her tough talk, back when it came at the expense of corrupt liberals. But on Thursday, Democratic Reform Minister Pierre Poilievre wouldn't even say Fraser's name out loud when the NDP confronted him with her criticism.
Mr. Speaker, we've already said that we were aware of Elections Canada's positions on these issues. We just happen to disagree.
The Tories have nothing but enemies on electoral reform. Poilievre has hinted at possible amendments, but the NDP is circling like vultures. They won't be happy until the government admits defeat and kills the bill.
Once again, with Question Period and Review, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on McLean's.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.